Worldwide with Deirdre Breckenridge introduces incredible stories shared by women across the globe who have experienced the great heights of success and, at times, the agony of defeat. With a vision to impart wisdom and advice on how to tackle barriers and soar to new heights, the show uncovers different perspectives to help you find your inner strength and to power up your own voice so you can excel in life.
Hi, everyone. I'm Deirdre Breckenridge. Thanks for tuning into another episode of Women Worldwide. We're going to dive right into our topic today because there's a lot to cover. It's the one-person business and how you can scale that business into a $1 million business. So for all of you entrepreneurs out there, get ready to learn from an expert who literally wrote the book on this topic. Joining me on the show is Elaine Pofel, an independent journalist who specializes in small business entrepreneurship and careers. She recognized the rise of the $1 million one-person business over the past 5 years. So she saw this trend, and it's actually the biggest trend in employment today. This type of business offers the widest range of people the most ways to earn a living while having the lifestyles that they want. And who doesn't want the best lifestyle as you design your career? In her book, The Million Dollar One-Person Business, published by Random House, Elaine outlines the pathways to joining this entrepreneurial movement, synthesizing advice from hundreds of business owners who've actually done this. Elaine is here to share her book and her journey with you. It's great to have you on my show, Elaine. Welcome.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Deirdre. I'm very excited to be here.
Well, we're excited to have you. And tapping into this trend of the $1 million one-person business is really interesting. So kind of want to start there with, what were you thinking when you did this? And maybe give us a little bit of the backstory about getting to book launch.
Sure, Deirdre. There's a long story behind this book, and I'll give you the high level. I've been a journalist writing about entrepreneurship and careers for many years. I've written many stories about scalable businesses. One thing I noticed was that no one was really covering the one-person business, although there are about 25 million non-employer businesses. That's what the government calls the businesses that don't have W-2s. It is a lot. Out of about 28 million, we just don't pay attention to them. And they're almost treated as failures to scale. When in fact, I found in a lot of my reporting that the folks running them are very, very happy with their situations. They love running one-person businesses, but they have some challenges. There's very little social safety net for people who run a one-person business. They don't have access to unemployment, even if they're just doing one contract job that's basically full-time and it dries up, even though they pay taxes like everyone else. If they don't have a spouse or partner whose job provides health care, they have to pay for it themselves. And I know from my own experience living in New Jersey, which is a high-cost state, it can cost as much as a mortgage for a family. So that makes the bar very high in terms of what people need to earn to live a middle-class life as a solo entrepreneur. So in thinking about this over the nearly 11 years that I've been in business, I concluded that the only answer for the moment until social policy changes, which may be never based on the rate that we're seeing it going, the only answer is to make more money. It really is, because if you can make enough that health insurance contribution really doesn't impact your lifestyle, you're in a pretty good situation. If you can make enough that you can put aside money to cushion yourself or your family from cash flow fluctuations, which affect every business at some point, you're in pretty good shape. The only way to do these things is to make more money than many people are making in one-person businesses. The average non-employer business brings in about $47,000. You'll have to double check me on that, but it's in that range. Right. And that's not enough to cover health insurance that, like, for my family costs $38,000 a year at one point just for the premiums alone, right? So that was one driver of the book. I came across some statistics from the U.S. Census Bureau on these non-employer businesses a few years back, and I noticed something really fascinating to me, knowing what most non-employer businesses make, and it was that there was a pocket of businesses bringing in between 1 million and 2.49 million in annual revenue. There were even some beyond that, bringing in more than $5 million, but they were very small, less than 400 in that category. But there was a decent number above 1 million. And I got very curious to see what they were doing because I didn't know anybody who was running a $1 million one person business. Fortunately, the Census Bureau does categorize the businesses by industry. So I wrote a blog post for Forbes about them saying, you know, so such and such a number are in retail, this number are in manufacturing, et cetera. And people got very curious and wrote to me and said, Elaine, we're glad to know what industries they are, but we need to know a little bit more. I mean, if they're in retail, are they doing e-commerce? What are they selling?
Right. And how are they doing it?
Yeah. Well, that's the other big question. So
yeah.
So I wrote to the readers and I said, I can't find this out from the Census Bureau because as we probably all would wish, they do not give out people's private information from those census forms we fill out.
Sure.
But that gives us a little bit of a mystery as to, you know, who are these people? So if you're one of them, please write to me. So some of them started writing to me and they included someone who's running a spy camera store online, Alan Walton, Dan Mezeritsky, who was a Canadian he was an athlete who became a personal trainer, developed a system for training other trainers and licensing out his brand, and became a sort of franchise. There was a woman running a babysitting company, Rachel Charlupsky, who is a young woman who started the business while in college and today has 2,500 babysitters as contractors.
Oh my gosh.
Very, very interesting. So that post went bananas viral. Today it has, I think, 340,000 page views. And so I realized readers are very curious about this. They're much more curious about this than anything else I've ever written about in many years. So each time I found one, I would profile them and draw out what they were doing that was different, because wouldn't we all like to know that, right? You know, for the person maybe who's successful in their business, maybe they're making $100,000 or $200,000, that mystery of how do you get to 1 million?
And that's all before you ever hire your first employee.
Exactly. Because that the challenge and the ceiling on it is usually the limits of what one person can get done in a day or a week or a month. I mean, you can always increase revenue if you're willing to work 20 hours a day, but eventually that's going to destroy your health and your personal life and everything else. So that's not sustainable, even if there might be a week out of the year that you have to do that for some project you're getting done. So that's not the answer. So in interviewing them, today I've probably interviewed more than 50 of them, but by the time I wrote the book, I included the stories of about 40 entrepreneurs who were in 32 businesses. Some were husband and wife couple teams, and you know, some were partnerships, so that's why the number is slightly different. And I was able to find out that they had some common threads. One of them is automation. They are heavier reliers on automation, which is not a new idea. We've been hearing about it for a long time, but they really do it. They close that knowing-doing gap. I mean, how many people say to themselves, I'm going to connect my QuickBooks to my bank account and then never do it, right? We all have this list of things that we say we're going to do, and then it's a sunny day, we want to go for a walk, or we have a project that's due and we never get around to it. And then years pass and we're still doing a lot of things manually that really don't need to be done that way. These folks are pretty serious about making the time for operations. There really are operations in a one-person business.
Oh, Elaine, can I just interject for a second?
Yes.
Do you feel these folks are more technologically savvy, and that's why they can kind of have the close the knowing-doing gap, QuickBooks to the bank account? Is there anything that where technology and how much they're willing to get out of their comfort zone plays a part?
I don't think they're any more tech savvy than anyone else because they're not using highly elaborate technologies. They're mostly using apps and tools, things like Calendly to schedule their appointments. I know I use another service like that called Schedule Once. I probably schedule 20 appointments by phone some weeks, being a journalist. Mm-hmm. That saves me 3 or 4 hours a week sometimes of not emailing back and forth, searching for lost emails about when was that interview time and that sort of thing. So just something like that can give you back half a day a week. And I'm not a techie. You know, that was something extremely easy to set up. I use Everlance to track my mileage. Very easy to add to my smartphone. It has caught so much mileage that I would not be writing down, which my accountant likes because it's a deduction. Things like that are really easy and designed for the layperson. I have come across a few that are a little bit more tech savvy, but I would say that's not really the norm. I think they tend to hire tech talent if they need it rather than try to reinvent the wheel and teach themselves. Another thing that I should point out is these are non-employer businesses by the government's definition, meaning the owners are the only employees. That doesn't mean no one else contributes to the business. So they may have freelancers who help them. And that's something that I think people can be afraid to try. They're afraid of trusting anyone else with the work in their business.
Yes.
These folks are recognizing that, hey, if I'm an accountant, it really does not make sense for me to design my own website. I cannot do it efficiently. I'm never going to have the body of knowledge and the skills that someone who is a trained web designer will have. They can put up a website for me in one afternoon that looks great. Meanwhile, I'll be losing a week's worth of work doing the same thing.
And it just won't look as great.
Because I don't know my way around. Yeah, exactly. So they recognize that. One thing I should point out is, a lot of people know it's important to delegate, but they feel like they can't afford the cash flow crunch of having an employee. And that's a real consideration. When you have someone on payroll, you have to cut the checks on a certain date. You have to, in many states, have workers' compensation. So that, you know, there are laws about that. You can't just slip because a client hasn't paid you. So that's a big commitment. But if you bring on a web designer for one project as a freelancer, that saves you from the stress of having to manage your cash flow to manage both your pay and someone else's. So this
right,
is
and there's no overhead for your
exactly.
freelancers and contractors.
And they love it too. I mean, I'm a freelancer. I don't want to be on payroll with any of my clients. I like the freedom of working for different clients and on different projects. I have a business and I don't want to have a job. So it's not cheating somebody out of a job who wants one. It's helping someone grow their business. The third component of it is outsourcing. So you'll find that this is a little different from freelancing. They will use back office services to extend what they can do. The easiest example for most of us to envision is fulfillment by Amazon. That means when you order something on Amazon, the owner of that little company whose name you see on the product listing isn't packing it up themselves. The goods are stored in a warehouse run by Amazon. Amazon ships it out. Amazon takes a cut in that person's sales, but it saves them a lot of time. Exactly. But that's not the only way people do it. In some industries, there are back office services that will do things like your invoicing for you or collections. And that is what allowed Harry Ein, one of the people in the book, to grow his business to $4 million in revenue from his garage. He sells swag, which are those tote bags that have a bank's name on them, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And he uses iPromoteYou, which is a specialized back office service for swag sellers. And what he did was early in the business, he used it very little, but as he has grown the business, he pays for more and more of that service so that he can go out and spend time with his enterprise clients and work on sales and the things that really improve revenue in the business and that only he can do. So those are the high level. I would say one other thing that I noticed is they take time away from the business a little bit. So they're not glued to their computer all the time. They recognize that they are their own most precious resource. If they're not functioning well, physically, emotionally, mentally, then the business isn't thriving. So they take time out for wellness. A lot of times it was a hard won lesson that they had to do that, but they do it. They get business coaches. So if they're hitting a roadblock and they can't get beyond 500,000 in revenue, they'll put their ego aside and say, I need help with this. I want to get to a million. And where are the gaps in my knowledge, or what am I not doing that I could be doing? They take classes and that sort of thing. They invest in personal development. Those were the things I thought were most different from entrepreneurs who kind of get to a certain point and then flatline.
Yeah. On the note of the business coach and kind of getting unstuck, I'm noticing a lot of mastermind classes popping up. We had a few friends over recently. I was chatting with one gentleman and he was saying, yeah, I really wanted to do this mastermind because, it's going to get me to the next plateau. So I really do think that is catching on. When it comes to your book and who benefits, do you think it's solely the person who already is in business that wants to get to the next step? Or would you even recommend it to somebody who's thinking about that side hustle who hasn't made the leap yet?
I think it's for both. I have, I've had a number of events where I've done panel discussions with the entrepreneurs from the book, which is a lot of fun because you get to hear it in their words, not mine. And a lot of the people that have been coming are people with corporate jobs who want to leave, but they don't know how to come up with an idea to start a business. They don't know how to take those first steps. And there are exercises in the appendix that a lot of people have told me were very useful to them, where I reverse engineered the thinking process of some of the entrepreneurs as far as coming up with their idea. And more importantly, taking the risk out of the equation and testing it. Because I don't recommend anybody just quit a job and start a business. Right. The side hustle is a really good idea. One example from the book who's in the opening chapter, Laszlo Nadler, sells planners under the brand Tools for Wisdom on Amazon. They're a little different from the typical day book in that it's not just a list of the to-dos you need to check off a list on this day, but rather, what do you need to do this day and this week to move you towards your life's highest purpose? He's got a big following of people who like that personal development vibe. And he really wanted to do this for a long time before he actually took the leap and went full-time. He started it in 2012. For 2 years, he kept his full-time job at Bank of America. He had an at-home wife and two children, so he was the main breadwinner. He didn't have the luxury of just quitting, and he tested it out. I think he told me the first year he made about $12,000 from the business, and he got feedback from his customers, kept improving the designs, and after 2 years, he was at six figures, and then he felt confident that he could cover his expenses, invest in growing the business. Now he's at $2 million in annual revenue. He got there on his own with a few freelancers and he just hired his first employee. But he took the risk out by testing it. And I really recommend people do that because not everybody can live with that seat of the pants approach. I mean, we all read these stories of people who, you know, mortgage their house and finance it on all their credit cards and then had this incredible success, but that's the exception. And it's a very stressful way for most people to live. I think there are a lot of people that are somewhat entrepreneurial, but not extreme risk takers who would be much better off with a side hustle and then growing it gradually until they can go full time with it.
Did you always see yourself as an entrepreneur? And I mean, I know that journalism plays a part, but did you also see yourself as an author of a book published by Random House?
None of the above. I really didn't. I was a happy employee. I had a job at Time Inc. before I started this book. I was a senior editor at Fortune Small Business Magazine. It was a great place to work. I really enjoyed working with my colleagues. I liked corporate life. I really enjoyed everything about having a job.
That's interesting. You're one of the few that says, I like corporate life. That's awesome.
Well, I was getting to part B of that, which is that I then had children. And they were in the NICU for 3 months after they were born. I worked at a very flexible work from home arrangement where I worked from home 4 out of 5 days a week. And I was able to continue that for 4 years because it worked better. I had another child about 2 years after that. Now I have 4 children. But what I found was at a certain point, my whole life was logistics. It was just the structure of a corporate job, even as flexible as it was, didn't quite work with managing a large family and really having unpressured time to enjoy my job and enjoy my children and my husband in the way that I wanted to. So I started to find myself envying the freelance writers that I was hiring to write stories and thinking.
That's when you know it's time for a switch.
Yeah, they control their time. And that's what I realized I needed was 100% control of my time. So then the onus was on me to figure out, okay, well, how do I do that as someone whose income is needed to support my family? And how do I do that in such a way that we can afford health insurance? Because my husband had a business, so we got our health care through his job. And that was not a small matter when you have premature twins. At one point, one of my daughters had a heart operation. And, you know, just having twins in the NICU for 3 months makes you fully aware of what hospital bills actually cost. So I didn't want to take a chance on that. I am not a risk taker with that sort of thing. And by the way, just as an aside for anyone listening who does not run a business, I did research on this for the book to make, say, let's say your base salary was $100,000 for simplicity's sake. To cover the cost of your benefits in a business, your revenue would need to be $130,000 minimum. That's based on the government's estimates of what benefits are worth. But I think you need to make at least $140,000 because you also need a cash cushion to cover you in case of late payments and things at a minimum. So that's kind of what I learned the hard way, because the first couple of years I was like, oh, how come I'm making around what I made in my job, but it just seems so hard. And then it sort of slowly dawned on me, well, because we're paying these insane insurance premiums that cost a lot, you know, and so I have to make more than that. And that was really an awakening and made me more entrepreneurial. The first couple of years, I was mainly focused on journalism because I thought, oh, I'm a journalist. And I was really just creating a job for myself. I don't want to say just because that in itself is not so easy. But then I thought, how do I build on this? And then that led me into doing other types of work that essentially subsidized the journalism, which isn't a high paying field, as everyone knows. So I would do things like content marketing or ghostwriting and do retainer work for clients. All of these things sort of evolved naturally. It wasn't an overnight decision where I said, okay, I'm going to take on retainer clients. And then suddenly they appeared. But it was more of a natural morphing out of relationships where I was doing work for the same people over and over again. And it would be more cost effective for them to hire me on a more ongoing basis.
Well, it's really interesting the way that everything evolved naturally. And sometimes that's the best way that you find your way and then it's not actually forced. And Elaine, I'm going to ask you to hold your thoughts for just a moment. We're going to take a super quick break to give some love to our sponsor. And I also want to mention that Women Worldwide is on the C-Suite Radio Network. And you can find our shows at c-suiteradio.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out all of the other great business podcasts as well.
You have been listening to Women Worldwide with your host, Deirdre Breckenridge. Segment 2 is coming right up.
Creating brand loyalty requires a unique blend of strategic communication and innovative technology. Pure Performance Communications works with businesses to move their audiences from awareness to action and impact by offering a digital marketing roadmap. Let us help you foster deeper engagement and forge stronger relationships along the way. Visit us at pureperformancecom.com. That's pureperformancecom with 2 M's.com.
Now back to Women Worldwide with your host, Deirdre Breckenridge.
I'm Deirdre Breckenridge. Welcome back to the show. Elaine Pofelt and I were just chatting about the $1 million one person business and her journey. So Elaine, you were just kind of sharing some interesting information about your journey and how when you were corporate, the logistics really weren't working out and you found your entrepreneurial path. And it was really kind of, it was more organic and less risk. I'm definitely a calculated risk type of entrepreneur. And I'm just wondering, what do you think you've learned? What is that one lesson that you can take from corporate into your entrepreneurial movement as a journalist and a woman in business?
The number one thing that I've learned is the importance of relationships. All of the relationships you're forming in a corporate job or even in your community can contribute to your business. I'm not talking about calculating relationships so that they later pay off for you, just the natural types of relationships that you form, chit-chatting with people at the water cooler or in the next office or when you're volunteering at a community project in mysterious ways will help your business. And I'll tell you a little story about that. There, when I was at Time Inc., there used to be an email newsletter I sent out, and it had an ad on it. And every once in a while, the woman who sold the ad would say, could you hold this newsletter until the next day because we're closing the deal with the sponsor. They weren't quite ready to commit today, but we think we'll have it by tomorrow. It didn't really matter what day the newsletter went out, and I didn't really think of it as that big of a favor. I just did it because it seemed practical. It seemed like it would help the company, and she seemed very nice. And when I started my business, I did an informational meeting with someone at my company who I didn't know. Time Inc. is a really big company, so it has a lot of different divisions. And he said, there's someone here who would like to say hello to you. And lo and behold, this woman pops out and she said, hi, you know, I have a project for you. And I said, wow, that's awesome. It turned out to be a very well-paying consulting contract that lasted the whole year. And it really gave me a nice transition into freelancing because it gave me the FaceTime with a client, which I was still used to from having a corporate job. I was working with her. She was lovely. We had never actually really collaborated together. And I thought she wouldn't have really known me if it hadn't been for those interactions. And I never in a million years thought it would result in us working together. But it was just one of those little mysterious things in life where you form a connection and then years later, it winds up helping you in interesting ways. So even if you think you're new to entrepreneurship, you're not new to business relationships. If you've had even a single job, even if you're very young and listening to this and all you've had have been summer jobs, you've still met people through those jobs and they will help you in ways that you cannot imagine. That's why it's always worthwhile to, beyond talking with people in a transactional way, get to know them and take the time to care about them. Even if it seems like you're not getting the work done and keeping your head down, that's part of the business world and it makes it much more fun to do business and it's never, ever a waste of time. So that's what that's the lesson I took away. And it's why a lot of times when I work with someone, I don't keep the call to 15 minutes. I'll set aside a half an hour so I can get to know them because often there are ways I can help them. And I don't know if they're going to help me or not. Who knows? But at least I've made a new friend from it. And I think it all kind of plays into the karma of a business in surprising ways that make it much more fun to go through life as an entrepreneur.
I love that you said in business, getting to know people, and even if you need more time to do that, you just never know, like you said, where these relationships will pop up again. And I also feel that that's why you should never burn bridges because at the same time where somebody might have a really good experience with you and somewhere else you can do great things together, if you have a not so good experience and you carry that forward, you never know where that person might be in your business path again.
I think you're right about that. It can be hard, I think, for freelancers sometimes. I know, just having been an assigning editor, when people feel they're in survival mode, it can bring out the worst in them. So usually that means a late payment, right? It's easy. Sometimes an invoice can get lost in a big company. and the person has to pay their rent. And so when they call you, they're in an emotional state of mind because they're worried and desperate, right? And it, there might not be something you on the inside of the company can do to expedite it instantly. There might be some, you know, you can do a little bit, but maybe it involves three other people to really get that check cut that day. So if you're that person who's stressed, it's really, really important, whether it's collecting payments or you're dealing with a difficult client, to find some way to manage your emotions before you talk with people. Because that's where I see people, they do burn bridges because they let the situation get the better of them. They're often very nice people, but they just fly off the handle. And that's something people will remember, and it can hurt your business. So if you can say to yourself, and even the client, well, I'm a professional and this is how I handle it, that will kind of remind you to keep it professional. Even if you don't verbally say it, think about how would the utmost professional handle this? And it will help you channel that perfect professional. even in a situation where you might be afraid you're getting burned, it's never worth it to treat another person badly, because you can always, there's always some way to work things out. Even if I never have had to do this, but I mean, it could be through the legal system. I know sometimes people might go to small claims court for payment. It's never worth being mean or rude to another person or having a temper tantrum. So if you can't call calmly, then it's better to go for a walk and wait until you can, or even sometimes using a third party can help. If you're, for instance, if you're collecting and you have a bookkeeper and you're just so tired of writing to their AP department, you could have your bookkeeper send an email on your behalf. So it's a different person just to take you out of the equation and keep things calm. So I think you're so right about that, dear. Do people can be their own worst enemy. But once you're aware of that, when you feel, I mean, we all have emotion in business. When you feel it rising up, you can put yourself in check and say, wait a minute, I'm about to blow my stack. I feel it. And I'm not going to let it happen. I'm going to take a breath.
Exactly. You sound very calm, which just begs a question. How do you keep yourself calm and healthy and not just focused on your business, but also your family as well? What are you doing?
The thing that I have been doing lately is hot yoga. I have had to learn gradually to take more care of myself, because I have found there have been points where I've really reached the point of physical burnout in my business. You can imagine, you're a mother. My children are now ages 8 to 14, but I had a lot of small children at one time. I didn't take time off from work, so I was always juggling a lot, like a lot of working parents. And there were times when there was imbalance. I mean, it's not that easy to get to the hot yoga studio when your children are ages 3 and 1, you know. it's not easy. You know, that's why there's not a lot of women with children that age who are there at that time.
What is hot yoga?
It's in a room that's like 100 degrees.
Oh my
gosh. It's very challenging, but it's so hard that it almost, I have never been able to meditate. So all you can think about is doing the yoga in that room. So it forces you to meditate.
And
the sweating, I guess, helps you get rid of toxins in theory, which I think is probably good too. I do a combination of things. I do that. I run or walk, and I do cycling, depending on the weather. I do Taekwondo 3 times a week with two of my daughters.
And you also do that with your girls too. I think you mentioned that in an earlier conversation.
Yeah. It's funny. I didn't really envision myself doing that. It's not something that I grew up doing as a girl fighting, but I thought it would be good for building confidence. So I enrolled, my older daughters are twins. So I enrolled one of them in karate and one of them in Taekwondo. And the Taekwondo was a little more convenient for me because it was at our local YMCA, and I figured it would be easier for me to get to. So after watching her on the sidelines for a while, and saying, you know, I always complain, I have no time to exercise, and I'm sitting here for an hour watching the class, I might as well do it.
Wow.
And there was one mom in the class at the time who had 4 boys, and one of the boys was in the class, and she was a multi-degree black belt, so far, far ahead of where I was starting out. But I thought, if she can do it, I can I can at least get started. I may never be as good as her, but I'm just doing it for the exercise anyway. And then I kind of got hooked on it. And my younger daughter signed up. And then we've all tested now for our black belts. So now we're all black belts in Taekwondo.
But it's awesome. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
It's hard to get.
It took a while, and I'm not a natural at it. I'm one of these people that has no sense of direction. So when I'm driving, I invariably get lost. And there are a lot of forms in Taekwondo where you're turning right or left or whatever. And I realized this is just something about me. I'm just not, good at figuring out whether to do this. So my daughters will learn things after watching them 2 times. I've got to practice them 50 times before I feel confident. But I think that's also part of being a midlife learner. Too. I mean, it's just, someone who's 12 years old or 14 years old, their brain is a sponge. Our brains are cluttered with concerns about our mortgage and the project we have to do and other things. So it's kind of like learning a language. And if you realize that, you can get past the feelings of vulnerability. It's actually been one of the things that's helped me most in being self-employed, because it helps you get out of your comfort zone, do things where sometimes you're in front of the whole class doing something where you feel just ridiculous and you're not doing it right. And the teacher is correcting you. And I think as adults, we always feel like we have to be perfect in public. And it helped break me of that, which then frees you up to trying new things, because we all have to try new things in our careers now with digital technologies. Like I had to do a podcast interview, which is something none of us were doing 10 years ago, right? Where I was the host like you. I didn't know how to do it. I had to learn how to use the equipment. I had to do a lot of things I had never done before. And I think I might not have been willing to even try that if I had not done Taekwondo and said, you know what, I've gotten through that situation before where I felt completely helpless to do this perfectly. I'm just going to do the best that I can and keep practicing it until I get better. And that's an important lesson. I don't know if you have to do Taekwondo to pick that up. It's probably learning anything new where you're pushed out of your comfort zone.
To get the confidence and courage to do different things.
Yeah, it's really interesting because in terms of self-defense, it's actually made me realize, I mean, I live in suburbia, so it's not a place where I'm having to defend myself on the streets very often or at all.
I'm in New Jersey.
But you never know. But it's actually given me a healthy respect for how strong some people are. It's unbelievable, and made me realize that you don't really want to get in any fights if you can help it. Not that I really was before, but the lessons for me have been more mental, about just getting into that area where you're very uncomfortable and you're doing brand new things and you feel awkward, and just being able to get past that. Because that's, even starting a business is like that when you think about it. If you've always had a job, all of a sudden it's the first day and you don't know what to do with your time. This came up on one of the panels with Colin and Angie Raja, run something called Rim Sports. They're not in the book because I met them after I wrote it. But I've written an article about them for Forbes, and they were both corporate people. He was in tech in the finance world, and she was in marketing. They were very into CrossFit and boxing, and she felt that there was no boxing gear for women that was attractive enough for them to wear. It was all in black and, not pretty colors and things. So they wound up starting their business and then leaving their corporate jobs. But she talked about this on the panel, how she was so used to the structured day of getting onto the train and going to work. And she did this at such and such a time that she felt really lost the first few months. And then she put some structure in place to guide her day so that she didn't feel that way anymore. And she was deciding, okay, this is the best use of my time. But it takes a little while. And I think that's why some people abandon it. They quit their job and they feel that way and they don't ride it out because they feel there's something wrong with it. And instead of saying, this is natural. Everyone feels this way. I've been working for 5 or 10 or 20 years with somebody telling me what I should do at every time of the day. Or even if I had some latitude, I do have to show up at a certain time. Realizing you can have that same structure. It's just, you have to decide how, maybe you spend the morning on sales, or on Tuesdays is when you go out and meet with clients or whatever it may be. That's natural. It doesn't mean you're failing. It's just part of getting set up. And I think that that's why I think it's important. You were talking about mastermind courses, even if you can't afford them, because sometimes they are quite steep. If you're in a brand new startup, you can go to meetups. There's so many groups for entrepreneurs, for women entrepreneurs, for entrepreneurs of every demographic, where you can have that community and talk to other people. And I find they're so open with each other. It's very different because in the corporate world, everybody always feels they have to put their best foot forward. And they,
right.
they
and their guard is up too.
In yeah, the exactly. But when you're all entrepreneurs, there's no hiding from that, you know, and people are honest. Yeah. And so just hearing that other people going through it can help you get through a bad day and say, you know what, it was a bad day. I didn't get a lot done. I had a problem with a client. I worked on this project and my work didn't go anywhere. But you know what, tomorrow is another day. Other people go through this too. I met this guy who's making $600,000 a year at this event. He went through it too. And I can be like him and or her. And that's important because you know, there's a lot of emotion to work. So if you can, if you can find community, that's a good way to manage it and keep yourself going and keep your spirit fueled.
Elaine, you've shared such great advice. I think I'm just going to ask you one simple question. Where can people find out more about you and your book?
They can go to $1,000,000onepersonbusiness.com. That's the website for the book. If they would like to get in touch with me, and I really welcome them to do this. I love hearing from other entrepreneurs. If they go to LinkedIn under my name or to Twitter, they can reach me and send me a message, or at my site, ElainePofeld.com. There's a private contact box if you want to send me a message that doesn't appear on a posting on social media. And please do write to me because I'm constantly reporting on entrepreneurship, and it's very helpful for me to know what are the challenges that are facing entrepreneurs. A lot of these things are changing by the day, by the way. There's a lot of disruption. A lot of people have nailed everything down and then something changes. And I'm in the lucky position as a journalist of being able to ask people questions and bring answers to people. So I have to know the questions. So I truly welcome anyone to write to me and get in touch.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for coming on the show, sharing your journey, mapping out a path to the $1,000,000 one person business. We really appreciate all of your advice today. So thank you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me as a guest, Deirdre. You asked great questions. I really, really enjoyed it.
Thank you. And I also want to thank all of you for tuning into Women Worldwide. And if you can, please just take a moment and rate us on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback. Okay, WW friends, until our next episode, stay focused, energized, and feeling empowered. Thank you.